Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva's first choice for NPR News.
To those 65 and older, numbered over 40 million in 2010 in the United States, and older women make up the majority of that population, edging out men by a ratio of 132 to every 100 men. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush, and this morning we're going to explore the world as it is faced by millions of these older women. A couple of statistics found that older men were more likely to be married, that is 72% versus 42% for women, and almost half of women aged 75 and older actually live alone. Take a look at what lies ahead in these golden years. We're joined in studio by Dr. Carolyn Stegman. She is with the IMAC Senior Center and also the author of A Gold Mend in Life, and we'll be talking about that in a moment. Also on hand is Adrienne Kadushin. She is a nurse psychotherapist, and welcome to you all. I want to turn first to the book because, Carolyn, because it is about an older woman. She turns 60, and she's newly separated and wants to begin, her life almost over again. And tell me, why did you decide that this was the book you wanted to write, and why did you choose, say, fiction as opposed to, say, something mm-hmm. that might be more in line with having just sort of a nonfiction book?
Well, first of all, we want to reframe aging. Heretofore, when we looked at our society, I think that our society has been age phobic, quite frankly, Don. And we have looked at it as, these seniors sitting around in an afghan with a plate of cookies and not really being active and productive and vibrant and connecting and so on like that. So I wanted to write a book that was going to look at the new way that we're framing aging. And why I wrote it is because when I was teaching at Salisbury University, I did a lot in experiential learning. And so therefore, I was really into storytelling. And so I wanted to write a wise book. That was my attempt. And something where people could look and say that I can relate to and I can see that or whatever. And fiction to me was, I don't know if I was naive or not, because I'd never written fiction before. Everything for me had been nonfiction. But I really enjoyed doing it, to tell a story.
Now, The book, of course, is about this woman, Claire Pennington, and some of the highlights include after she's sort of living alone, as it were, she gets her first job at a senior center. She meets one of the local folks, Edith, who's 80 years old. Also, she meets another man, is Scott, who's 65 years old. It seems almost the perfect man in the novel, as well as, of course, we meet her former husband, Ross, who gets cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you include these kinds of elements? Because one of the things that struck me was that in many ways, as I got to the end of the book, that I got the impression that this was a woman who actually wound up getting lucky, in a sense of getting a job, meeting somebody else, that this was all the upside, that everything kind of fell into place, including the financial end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as if she's a lucky one, as it were.
Well, there were probably parts of it that were luck. But her also re-motivation to energize herself, to show that life is never over. You can always start over, even at any age. And so she went out and basically plowed the field and got herself a job and then went back to school and then reinvigorated her friendship. And her relationship with Ross is based on forgiveness, that they spent so many years together. And instead of leaving a black hole in animosity and hate, the cancer did bring them together. And yes, the luck was that, he was an upper middle class man, and so she ended up there. But mostly I wanted to deal with the relationships of her life. And Edith is 80 years old, a fun-loving, snorkeling sage who just never stops. She's going to live until the day she dies. And that's what I wanted to do, because that's what life's about, to live until you die.
Well, I want you to go ahead and read. There's a section of the book near the very opening. in which Claire is standing and winds up standing in front of a mirror. And why don't you read a portion of it?
The first night in my apartment, I rummaged through boxes to find towels and took a long shower, then went to retrieve some clothes from the empty hollows of my new closet, passing through the dressing area with its full-length mirrors. My towel dropped to the floor as I carefully surveyed my body, something I hadn't done in a while. I was 60, but had been spared varicose veins or stretch marks on my 5.6 frame. My breasts drooped down, and my stomach, which had ceased being flat a few years ago, hung out slightly above the scar of my hysterectomy. I was every bit a semi-full-figured size 14. In the last years, I had clothed myself so my waist didn't show as much. A small amount of skin sagged under my partially raised arms, and a few skin tags presented themselves in various places. I liked my face and brown eyes, even my crow's feet, but could definitely do without the increasingly noticeable hanging skin under my chin, a genetic trait from my paternal side. I had thought about plastic surgery, but rejected it. I would be what I would be. Exercise had kept my body in shape, but lately I had fed my love-starved, empty life with food. I would have to watch that I just didn't continue this trend. I was attractive, but on that day, looking particularly tired, I could see only what was wrong with my body. Age spots had begun showing. My layered auburn hair exhibited gray. Rolling my left thumb across my ring finger, I felt for my missing wedding band, which I had rather ritualistic left on the dresser of my old bedroom for Ross to discover, hoping he would feel guilty as hell and terribly hurt. Oh, the psychological games we had played, and I still was. Also in the mirror, I began to see more than just my exterior. There was the tightness of anger around my mouth, the defensive stiffness of my posture, the deer in the headlights look in my eyes. I was a mess.
How much do you think describes the what many older women are going to right now from that passage? Do you think, I mean, obviously you've encapsulated this into a single moment, and mm-hmm. life is really carried out in a series of moments. So how much do you think that represents what older women, when they finally looking mm-hmm. at 60 and above?
Yes, I think it represents a lot of us in some way or another. We're aging, and aging comes with these physical changes in our body. So we're not these sort of, you know, looking as sexual as we used to look. And for a lot of people, it's depressing. For others, and again, in the reframing of aging, we're trying to structure it that it's not depressing, that we can look at it. This is our body. We are still sexual, we are still active, and we still, have a lot to give and contribute.
Now, because one of the things in our culture, looks are obviously emphasized, youth is emphasized, and for women in particular, there are all these products that are sold to women throughout their entire lives, from makeup, and if you get older, you have Botox, and so on and so forth. Do you think there's a greater pressure on women to think about how they look as opposed to, say, men as you get older?
I think so. I think that, yes, you're right. The Botox, the everything to try and capture that youth, the essence of that youth. And, you know, it only goes so far. You might look better, but you still have a lot of other things that you might have to deal with, psychological and so on like that, confidence levels and things like that. And the other thing about aging is, let's face it, the older you get, it represents death is coming. You know, it's the last phase of your life as you get older. And, and a lot of times that's not too happy to look at. And so ones are always trying to recapture that youth. And the other thing, Don, is that men sometimes, you see sometimes men with a lot younger women by their side, but you don't see it so much with women having younger men. They call it cougar now. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, you know, you see it sometimes. But for the most part, men have been accepted with their gray sideburns and their, you know, they look dignified, whereas a woman might, you know, be considered just looking older, haggard even. And you even see that as far as like cards, Hallmark cards or whatever for birthdays and stuff like that. You see sort of this haggard old woman depicting over the hill and things like that. That's what we need to change.
I want to turn to Adrienne Kadushin. She's a nurse, a psychotherapist. And Adrienne, can lean a bit forward for the microphone. And this moment of recognition, is this a common thing? Do women come to a moment and realize that they've now moved into something that's much different than they have to adjust? Or does this kind of thing happen over time?
I think it's a very gradual process, one that is easily ignored for a long period of time, although, as Carolyn is pointing out, it's hard to ignore with Madison Avenue and advertising and the pressure on to seek eternal youth. And I think that really what happens to this character in the book is that she's faced with having to look at all aspects of herself and take a look at the meaning of her life. And it becomes clear that the superficial is not where she needs to be. She really needs to look more deeply at her relationships. But the pressure is on to look young. But I think that in this book, we take a look at characters, male and female, who are struggling with this. And I do think today, actually, that men have as much body image problem as women, except women talk about it more. And I think what's interesting here is that women may lead the way in terms of discussion and communication, but I think what Carolyn is achieving in this book is really showing, although the main character is female, all the men in her life have a tremendous need to communicate and talk about their insecurities, whether it's her new relationship in Scott, whether it's her her good male friend who's gay, who's talking about grief and loss. Throughout this book, it seems like Claire is lucky, but there's a very subtle, beautiful arc here where everybody is experiencing pain, transition, major upheavals in their lives, and body image is very integrated into that, whether it's sexual activity, whether it's death and dying, whether it's cancer, whether it's the issue of how do I recreate myself and have to build relationships again in building a career, going to school, in all the different areas of my life, how am I going to appear? And fortunately, this character is beginning to see that it's much more than skin deep. But this issue of wrinkles and looking at oneself can create a lot of depression and feeling of wanting to hide from oneself, and then a loss of self-esteem and an unwillingness to engage in communication.
I was going to ask you about depression because as I was researching for it, interestingly enough, what's been called the silent generation, which are those folks who were, say, born during the 1930s, for women, they actually seem to have the lowest incident of depression, as opposed to the baby boom generation, which apparently experiencing a much greater amount of depression. What do you think that is, Carolyn?
Well, I think it's underreported, particularly for the older section. You know, they are the ones that keep a stiff upper lip, you know, keep your skeletons in the closet. They will go to a physician and he'll say, you know, how are you doing emotionally in every other way? And they'll go, fine. Even if, you know, they are not fine in any way, shape, or form, they would not admit it because you don't bear your soul in that. In fact, what we find, Don, is that many families will actually say, mother, I think, is getting Alzheimer's disease. And that's how they're reported. They go to the physician and they find out it's actually depression. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, actually, if you will, you were reading a quote earlier. I'd like to go to the very back of the book here and read what Claire's therapist, Shirley Hendricks, the character who's her therapist throughout. And she says, you know, mental health is renewed empathy for our lives, a vitality, which is quite the opposite of depression. And again, that gets to, I think, one of the main issues is unrealistic expectations. And when we have unrealistic expectations for our bodies, for the development of our minds, our brains, for what we are capable of, we miss what we're capable of in the new phase of our lives. We go through many chapters. But if we focus just on youth and we feel like that is the place where we're going to be most productive, then we're going to lose sight of and have unrealistic expectations of how we should perform as we age. And I think as the baby boomers come along, in reference to your baby boomers, they've been raised to have very high expectations of what is possible. You know, they come on, you know, there's, I think it's from 1943 to the 60s, right. And everything is possible. You know, there's an explosion of technology. There's an explosion of educational opportunities with the GI Bill. And all you hear today is, oh, being 60 is the new 50 and 70 is the new 60. So I'm never going to catch up. Because if I should really feel in the depths of my soul that I really am 70 and not 60, I better put that in the closet. That's just not acceptable. Well, we're taking a look now at a whole different way of believing that actually there's so many gifts that the older generations, some of the words that we use also, the lingo is terrible. The aged, the elderly, this, mm-hmm. you know, it lends itself to feeling you're one step out of the grave when that's really not true. When you introduce me as a nurse psychotherapist, I feel I do a lot of life coaching, actually, because it's a recognition of, you know what, you're not ill. You just need to do a lot of, you just really need to pay attention to the story you're telling yourself about who you are and where you fit in all aspects of your life and what you can contribute. And if you give yourself a lot of what we call negative self-talk, you're going to get real depressed.
Let me ask you, because you allude in this book to this relationship that she has with her former husband, and it's almost as if there is this section of her life spans several decades in which it almost as if it's been wasted because this relationship just was not the way that as she looks back, was obviously not what she had ultimately yeah. wanted. Do you think that's common? I mean, do you think that particularly as a generation, that maybe we concentrated on the wrong things, and that when we find ourselves, women in particular, because mm-hmm. they come out of their homes with their children gone and so on, that maybe we look back and that maybe we look for the wrong things?
Yeah. Claire was a classic underachiever, and probably to a large degree than most. But we all are in a certain way. I mean, not really becoming self-actualized and realizing our full potential through whatever reasons that we do. And so I think at first she did look at it as wasted, and it was very depressing for her, and that's why I took her to therapy in the book, and it was really very helpful for her to get a grasp on, number one, forgive yourself, and you're 60, you're not dead. And so she was able to do those things. And then she had left college. She had to get married, which was a big thing back in the 60s. Birth control was not available to single women. There was still experimentation going on. She and Ross both messed up. But they, because of their family upbringing, they took the bull by the horns and they raised those kids and did well. But she withered away. He was allowed to, which is, again, a 60s genre, to realize his more full potential. And she wasn't. And it was depressing. She did very well, or almost very well, with parenting, raised three good, productive, tax-paying kids, but she had never really looked at herself. And so the divorce, so her and Ross really became like siblings. There's a lot of marriages like that. They geographically live in the same house, but the love, the passion, the spark, all those things, the real love has sort of left, and they don't know how to re-energize that into their lives. And she probably would have stayed with Ross and never realized anything. But the divorce was the big shakeup, the dither effect that got her moving again. And she was able to really do a good job of it, really move well.
Now, one of the characters we mentioned a moment ago is Edith, 80 years old. And there's a couple of issues we talk about in terms of death. I think there's a quote that says, does death get any easier with practice? And it does refer to really she gets involved with somebody and then he's got some problems and I think ultimately passes away and then she's looking at somebody else and obviously she's 80 but she could be 65 for that matter in which these relationships are temporary in the real sense that people die in a short period of time rather than thinking, oh, in 50, 60 years, you know, I have to worry about it. What were you trying to say about that when she talks about the idea or the question whether or not death gets any easier with practice?
It revolves around loss, And the older you get, I'm going to be 67 on my next birthday. I'm burying more people than I ever did. I'm going to a funeral on Sunday for somebody who was a dear friend of mine. And it doesn't get easier. You know, sometimes you think if you have practice doing things like any other activity or whatever, you get better at it. You don't get better at going to funerals. It hurts because I think in the bottom line is you're lined up with yourself to think, when is it going to be my turn? And so you see loss because in aging, there is loss. There's loss of youth, loss of maybe job, loss of your car, all those things that made you independent and other things. And so the loss of friends. My mother-in-law once said to me, she said, I hate to open the newspaper to the obituary for fear there'll be another friend of mine in there. And I think that really captures what it is to see the acquaintances and the friends that are going. It makes it very hard. It makes you, you know, look and say, oh my God, you know, when is it, you know, when am I going to be there?
Adrian, how do you see the people, the older people dealing with this increasing passage of time and passing of friends?
Well, I'd like to, you know, piggyback on what you're talking about here. Loss doesn't get easier if you're fully engaged in life and love. And there's a passage, and I don't have the reference in it into the book right now, but there's a passage which is very meaningful to me because I've said it many times. If you're going to be fully engaged in loving relationships, loving, committed, intimate relationships, you are always going to feel extreme pain. We say these cliches. Without pain, there's no gain. You know, without love, you can have death by a thousand cuts, or you can hemorrhage. And by that, what I mean is that when you're fully engaged, and you open yourself up to being intimate and self-disclosing and close to another human being, and feel that intense relationship with another human being, when that person dies, lost to an illness or whatever, you are going to feel that intensity, but it's worth it. And that's what people have to see. You know, I'd like to comment that, you know, Carolyn asked me to be here today because we've worked together over the years in many different, you know, realms. And I've loved her courses. So she'll ask me to come in and we'll talk about sex and aging and death and dying and many different topics. And what I love is that Carolyn weaves in these characters, the ability of their resiliency to come back. You may feel tremendous loss, but from that you recognize that it's been so worth it. You have more to give again. You can do that. You can. People are afraid of grief and loss. They're afraid that they're going to, you know, we have a culture that only wants to be happy. We want to be beautiful. We want to be happy. And the other palette, the rest of the palette that includes tens and tens of different moods that we get into are somehow less than. They're negative. But it's okay to grieve. It's okay to lose and to realize we can survive that. It's human size, pain and suffering that is a part of the life process. And death is part of that. And what I loved about going into Carolyn's classes at the university on sex and aging is that, it wasn't called sex and aging. It was called whatever your course was. But I'd come in and we'd talk about sex and aging.
Psychology
of aging. My husband and I would come in and talk about that. And you could see that what we really need to do is educate people early, you know, so that they'd be more resilient. They'd feel that it's okay, that they don't have to feel that they are, they're going to disintegrate if they feel this intense grief and loss. So it's okay to challenge yourself to get deeply involved. And what does it mean to get engaged, to become engaged in life and relationship? You will feel like a part of you is dying when the other person is dying, but you will resolve that. You come out the other side. So in her classes, we would talk about that, the idea that, guess what? People are sexual and enjoy their intimacy and their physicality well through the decades. Well, they've never heard that before because their parents are not going to talk to them about it.
Let me interject right here, because one of the questions I had in the book, you deal with it and the issue of sexuality and sex and this older couple, Scott and Claire. And one of the things, by the way, that struck me is I was trying to figure out a way, a term to use, but I think there's a great deal of detail about what's going on in the bedroom for these two. Why did you feel compelled to provide that kind of detail in a book?
Because we asexualize older people. Even when I was teaching in class to some of my students, you know, to think that 60-year-olds or 70-year-olds or 80-year-olds were still passionate that they were making love was beyond them. In fact, at one point, Edith says in the book that she was holding hands with a friend of hers, a boyfriend, and somebody walked by and said, "Aren't they cute?" Like they somehow regressed them to the status of being a fourth grader. Fourth graders are cute when they're holding hands, but 80-year-olds, what are we doing? And so, and the other thing is that when you used to be a 10, a Tom Cruise or Julia Roberts, that's no longer the case. In fact, I learned that from Adrian. You're a 6 or you're an 8. And so there are problems. For women, it's atrophic vaginitis, which can be painful intercourse. And for men, it's erectile dysfunction. These are normal aspects of aging. And so what we were always doing was throw the pill. So now you've got these drugs where you got two people in a bathtub, you know, on television and whatever. And we're just saying, you know, if you got the flu, take this. And if you, you know, can't get it up, then take a pill. And but what we're trying to do is communication. And in the parts that I explicitly talked about sexuality, that the main sex organ was between their ears. It was their talking and their communication and their touching, because we don't sometimes touch. We just go right for the, you know, climax. And so I felt that that was important for people to look at that in later life and to realize that lovemaking, while they might be slower and it might not be as effective as, you know, not effective, excuse me, but not as, you know, quick as when you were younger, can still be ever so much as passionate as any of the lovemaking we see with younger people.
Actually, my view on this is Carolyn's book ought to be read by a lot of younger people as well as older people. They would learn a lot about their own sexuality. And there's a very nice way that this is presented in this book. It's not porn in any way. Not at all. Yeah. It is really done in a way that's very loving and very caring and very compassionate of each other's physical strengths and weaknesses, shall we say. And Claire, there's a way that she weaves in the book a lot of good sex education that I wish a lot of people would learn much sooner. So I think it's very interesting because if younger people, if this was marketed that way as well, that younger people should pick this up, it's not just for the geriatric grayheads running around here. They would, it could be part of an aging course, a course that young people would take that would give them, it's like prevention. You know, it's so much easier to build in the healthy attitudes rather than having to break down some of the other, the negative attitudes
exactly.
And realize, wow, all this time I wasn't getting in bed because I felt like if my penis was not fully erect, then I couldn't function. A lot of couples, by the way, come to us because they've given up sex because of performance anxiety. That they don't look the same, they don't behave the same, their body parts don't act the same. So they have the distance in their relationship is huge as a result. That we could build in, and this is from a physical, this is from a health, you know, a real health promotion kind of thing. This is not just for pleasure. This is for real health benefits that sexuality provides so much, you know, touching and closeness.
Yes, right.
Provides, it builds the immune system. I mean, we're taking a look scientifically at what this does. And the fact that with people would withdraw because, if I give my wife a hug, she's going to expect something from me, or vice versa. Is to lead to a lot of sickness, real physical as well as emotional and mental sickness when you don't have that intimacy and closeness. Life becomes pretty dull and gray and bleak and can lead to depression.
Now, the title of the book is A Gold-Mended Life. Explain a little bit about the metaphor because this has to do with the sort of... Yeah.
There's an ancient Japanese tradition that says when an object is broken, like porcelain or a vase or something like that, that we can either throw it away or we can put it together piecemeal with crazy glue and it sort of looks bad and we don't use it as much. But in this ancient Japanese tradition, they put it together with the lacquer from the urushi tree, and then they paint that crack with gold so that by the time it is mended, it is stronger and more beautiful than before it was broken. And, of course, that's the metaphor, is that all of us come broken in some way, shape, or form, but we can heal from that and we can be stronger and more beautiful.
You going to write another book?
I'm thinking about it, and it will definitely be about older persons.
Because, one of the matter of fact, one of the spots, and we'll have to close here. But there's a section in it when you're talking about, I think, sort of a leisure world, and you describe all these people who are like running around, some of the women, and so on and so forth. I thought, gee, there's another book, but that may be for another day. I don't know. We've been talking with Dr. Carolyn Stegman. She is author of a Gold-Mended Life, also at the Mac Senior Center, as well as Adrian Gadushin. She is a nurse psychotherapist, and appreciate both of you for coming in and talking about this. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.